this was announced as a strong gravity dock, but it's actually a holographic dock. I guess you already knew that from the title. It's actually a holography applied to condensed matter systems, in particular to superfluids, since I assume some of you may not be familiar with it, with this topic. Let me start by explaining what superfluids are and the difference between the S wave and P wave. It's related to the matter of superconductors. So a superconductor is a material which is an insulator at low temperatures, but if you get really close to zero, it develops a larger conductivity. In the same way, a superfluid is a fluid which at very low temperatures develops zero viscosity. In nature, sometimes the definition of what a superfluid is or a superconductor may get mixed up a little. So at the level of gauge theories, the definition that is adopted is that a superfluid is a field theory which develops some spontaneous symmetry breaking of a global symmetry, as opposed to the case of a superconductor in which the symmetry that would be broken is a local gauge symmetry. The most conventional superfluids, those which people don't know most about, are they can be explained as a Bose-Einstein condensation. The most well-known superfluid is helium-4. It's a well-known example. And the symmetry that is broken in this case is a U1 symmetry. So that is 1 degree of freedom that is absorbed by a Goldstone mode. This Goldstone mode is the phase of some complex function, and the gradient of this phase is known as superfluid velocity because this system, its hydrodynamics can be understood as a mixture of two fluids, one with its velocity and with one with this superfluid velocity. That would be known as S wave. Now, the P wave superfluid is a generalization. In this case, for helium-3, the idea is that instead of neutral atoms, you would have ions. And these ions get together to form bound states. So it's very reminiscent of BCS theory for superconductors. And more symmetries are broken, so more Goldstone modes are generated, and they enter the hydrodynamic description. These pairing states, they can be formed, and they are stable because at very low temperatures, their energy is below the Fermi energy. So that's it. That is the lowest energy of the available states that the ions or the electrons can occupy. Now, if you lower the temperature even more, you could have this analysis to excite the states of angular momentum or spin. And if that's the case, then you would have a vector. The vector given by this, the direction of this angular momentum. And when this happens, these Cooper pairs, they tend to align along some direction. So in this way, the isotropy of the system is broken because one special direction is selected. They are not as well known as the conventional superfluids, basically because they appear at a much lower temperature. But they are more interesting because since more modes enter the description, and because we have this symmetry breaking, they show several different phases. Like you could condensate the direction of the angular momentum or of the spin, or you could condensate the angle between them. So there's a whole bunch of phenomenology here. And also, I would comment on liquid crystals, which are an entirely different system. But what is similar is that in this case, you also have some symmetry breaking of the rotational symmetry. So a special direction is selected by the molecules of the crystal liquid, and that selects a special direction in space. What they are related to are high-temperature superconductors, but I won't talk about that. Even though it's interesting because that has applications to technology and such. This spontaneous symmetry breaking of the superfluid is reminiscent of the Higgs mechanism in particle physics. Because it's basically at the level of symmetries, it's the same thing. And also, you can define a complex function psi. So psi would be the operator that creates or annihilates bosons. And it gives the wave function of the bosons and also the phase. Like I said, you have a kind of Bose-Einstein condensation. So even each time that a boson is formed, it is formed with this particular value of the phase so that it coherently superposes with the rest of the bosons that are already in the system. That way, some special phase is selected on the Mexican hat potential. So that would be the case of a conventional superconductor or superfluid. But in our case, so I will talk about P-wave superfluids, as you might have guessed already. And this is the diagram of the symmetries that are broken in our case. So in principle, we had an SU2 symmetry, but that is explicitly broken. So the symmetry breaking, the spontaneous symmetry breaking takes place for a U1 symmetry, so like in the previous case, but also a symmetry breaking of the rotational symmetry in orbital space, which can be broken to some SO2 because of the selection of a preferred direction. So there are 3 degrees of freedom that are lost in this process, and that gives us 3 Goldstone modes that enter the hydrodynamics. I will be studying this system by means of a gravitational theory, in which what happens is that we have a black hole that develops vector hair. I will explain that later, but now let me introduce you the basic things that you need to know about the duality, in case you are not familiar with it. So the Gates gravity duality is an equivalence between a supergravity, a string theory in ADS geometry, and a conformal field theory. It takes place at large NC and in strong coupling, and in this limit, it reduces to classical gravity on the other side. There are some identifications to be made, like the energy scale of the field theory is related to a radial coordinate that you introduce in the ADS spacetime. The temperature of a black hole that you could introduce there is the same as the temperature of the dual field theory. And what I'm more interested in, any Gates field that you have in the bulk, it's related to the appearance of a global current in the dual field theory. So for instance, if the asymptotic expansion of the Gates field is of this form, so R is the extra coordinate, and the boundary is located at R equal infinity, then the first term would give the source of the field, and the second one would be related to the expected value of the associated operator. this correspondence is made more precise by saying that the, by equating the partition functions of both theories. Just in order to make more sense of all this, I will get into a little bit more of detail. So we would be working with a dictionary that relates every bulk field in the higher dimensional spacetime to an operator of the conformal field theory. So for instance, if you are talking about a scalar field with an axon of this kind, if the axon is of this kind, I can show that the asymptotic solution of the equations of motion takes typically this form, where nabla is given by this expression. So in order, first, just this will be appearing later, so I'm going to explain it. In order for this solution to be stable, see that we need a real value of nabla, because if it were complex, you would have exponential growth in the outer boundary, and we don't want that, because we don't want any divergences appearing in our field theory. So in order for this to be real, you need this to be positive, so the mass term can in principle become negative, but not too negative. This is known as the BF bound. In particular, if this is satisfied, it can be shown that the first solution is always non-normalizable, so it requires some finite value at the boundary, and it enters the boundary theory by adding an additional term to its axiom. And so this part of the solution enters as source of its associated operator. The other mode would in general be normalizable, so this would actually belong to the set of solutions that you would like to take into account when performing the quantization of the theory. Now, if you are claiming that this theory is equivalent, dual, to the field theory that you have on the boundary, you have to require that the Hilbert spaces of both theories are the same. So, and that translates into saying that each solution that I can find for this field that satisfies the normalizability condition must correspond to some state on the boundary theory. And in fact, the correspondence is such that its value at the boundary is related to the expected value of this associated operator for sourced by the first component of the field. In particular, if this first one is zero, so if you only have the normalizable mode, you will be computing the expected value in the absence of sources. So basically the message that you should have in mind is that this is the vacuum expected value of the operator, and the other thing is its source. This is useful, and this is like the only thing you need to know about the ADS-CFP in order for my talk to make sense. Because what I will be computing in the calculations that will be coming later are Green's function. A Green function is typically defined this way. So it's a correlator of two different operators. So assume that this operator appears in a term of the kind that I showed before. And it is sourced by a field phi b. Now, you would like to compute the expected value of the other, of the A operator, let's say. You would do it by using the density matrix of the axon. But after including this term, with some perturbation of the B field, they would have an additional term in the Hamiltonian. Well, it can be shown that the, if you take this and you insert it here, taking this into account, this complicated, in principle, correlator enters into this expression. So it's, so the change in the expected value of the A operator is the Green's function times the perturbation that you inserted at first in the B field. Thus, this taking into account that the Bartesian function of the two theories are equal, and that in this limit the gravitational theory reduces to its classical limit, means that the calculation of these coefficients simplifies a lot if you are doing it by means of the ADS CFT duality, because you only have to take derivatives of the axiom evaluated on cell. Yes, if I have this with some expected value here and I derive with respect to phi b, and then I derive again, the result is the Green's function. So you actually don't have to care about, well, any details that would be involved if you want to do it with perturbation theory. So far, that's the introduction. Now, the model that we are considering here is the theory of Einstein-Yangel theory with SG2 symmetry group. So it's just Einstein-Hilbert with a cosmological constant coupled to some SG2 gauge field. For this gauge field, we take these sunsets where phi takes some finite value on the boundary, whereas W doesn't. So basically, what we want to do is to realize this breaking of symmetries in this action. The first symmetry breaking that you want to realize is the explicit breaking of SU2 into just U1. And the way you do that is by inserting a chemical potential for three index of the gauge field. When you do that, you can understand it as saying that the SG2 symmetry would correspond to rotations in this flavor space of the 1, 2, 3 indices of the gauge field. And when you explicitly break the symmetry with a chemical potential, you reduce it to just the 1-2 plane. Now, W doesn't acquire value at the boundary, but it can acquire value for the next order. So this is like what I was explaining before. The term that is in front of 1 over r squared, that is related to the expected value of the associated operator of the component 1x of the gauge field. And that would be the component 1x of the current. So the coefficient that appears in this expansion is proportional to the expected value of j1x. And if the solution that you are studying in the ADS geometry has a non-zero value for this coefficient, then you are including a finite value for the current expected in vacuum. And that breaks two symmetries at the same time, because you are selecting one special direction in orbital space, and also another special direction in flavor space. Of course, the index x and or the name, the index 1, are just choices that I'm making. In principle, this symmetry is broken spontaneously, so it can choose any direction that it wants. So that's the idea. And now the answer to, that we take for the metric is this form. So what we do is we insert this into the action and then derive the Einstein's equations and Young-Mills equations. And it turns out that there are two possible solutions in general. One of them is the well-known Reisner-Nordström black hole. It's a charged black hole, basically, with asymptotic ADS conditions. But this solution doesn't source any current because it has the feature that the W component, so the 1x component of the gauge field, is exactly zero. The other solution, which can only be computed numerically, is a charged black hole with vector hair. That means that not only do you have a horizon, but also the 1x component of the gauge field is different from zero. It acquires some expected value, even though it's not normalizable. It acquires some value which is related to the expected value of the curve. Now the question is, which of the solutions will be realized? And that is answered by studying their thermodynamics. It turns out that this first solution is the ground state for large enough temperatures, whereas this one is the ground state for lower temperatures. And there's some critical value they're actually separated by a phase transition at this critical value of the chemical potential over the temperature.
Just one question. I work kind of in case two, where my mu over T is larger than the critical value. You say I couldn't find solution one.
No, you can find it, but it's not thermodynamically preferred.
Oh, okay.
What is the alpha squared on the phase diagram?
Ah, yes. It's the parameter of our action. So I'm including here an alpha squared in front of the F squared. Alpha is actually related to what would be the coupling of this gauge field. Times kappa 5, which appears in front of the axon. And you can understand it as the ratio of charged degrees of freedom over the total number of degrees of freedom. So by studying which is the critical value of mu over t for each value of the parameter alpha, we obtained this phase diagram. It was obtained by these people. From here up, the Reisner-Nordström solution is stable. That means that if I add some perturbations to it, it won't solve. It won't end up having some finite value of omega of W. Whereas in this part of the diagram, it is not stable. Like, it can be still a solution, but if I say plug in some small perturbations, it would grow until we end up with this other solution.
This particular form we chose for GXX versus GYY and GYZ, do you check that you can always achieve that gauge, or is this supposed to be anomalous subclass, or am I supposed to say that?
Anomalous?
So are you telling us that all solutions with this set of symmetries can be put in that cage, or is this just supposed to be a subclass?
Well, it's an ancestor that is taken that for which you can find a solution of the x and
I see what you mean, because it looks like there is a constraint between the work factors of dx and dy. But in fact, if you think there is, I think this is the most general answer right now, because you have r, choice. So you can think of this by writing it in this way, you fix the choice of r, you fix f, that fixes u.
Well, so if we wrote this down in general, we would put down the general function of r in front of, say, dx squared. And then we might say, and locally it looks like this is chosen, so r squared is really the volume. The factors of f cancel. Which I'm sure you could do locally, but I don't know whether you can always do locally. And unlike the usual things where I would usually put this in the GRR component, it's not clear to me whether you can adopt
that. Okay, what do you mean locally? Locally, this is a most general ansatz, and the GR equations are whole.
No, locally in the manifold. So for some segment of R, I have no problem with this, but with the end of this for all R, it's not entirely clear to me if this is the moment.
You agree that locally that's the most general concept?
Locally, I'm happy to believe that locally you could do this.
But I mean, there is not much to do.
Well, no, because you've written the GXX, in general, would start by writing that as some general function of R.
Right.
And then I would say, and then if I want to choose some specific gauge.
So I am choosing a gauge when they are volume. A warped volume of, I'm choosing my radial coordinate when the warped volume of dx, dy, and dz is equal to r, or r.
Yeah.
That's my choice of r. So there is no problem with it. And then I'm saying that because there are two different warp factors, I'm going to compensate for the different warp factors by introducing the additional.
Well, I just have no scenarios where you can try to do that and you have a global.
But I agree that globally there could be issues, but what I'm saying is that locally that's the most general answer. So then, you know, if he finds all the solutions locally, then the question is, does all of those local solutions can be extended to local solutions? Something along this line.
Yeah, well,
I'm just saying that he cannot lose solutions. If he finds all the local solutions, I don't think that he will lose any solutions.
Well, in another context, I know what counterexample that type of thing. But it also does, okay, these are what I'm exploring. Proceed along.
Okay. So, what was your confusion about?
I'm sorry.
What would you ask?
No, I'm happy. You go.
Okay. So, now I was going to explain you the intuitive picture behind these solutions. Basically, we have a horizon here that is charged. So, if we were in some asymptotically flat spacetime, say any condensate that is formed here of this charged field would be expelled upwards up to infinity. So you wouldn't develop anything on the horizon of the black hole. But in ADS spacetime, it has this special feature that the geodesics of that are followed by massive particles do not reach the boundary. So there are two effects at play, and the result is that the condensate condenses at some finite distance. Usually say that it condenses near the horizon, which means that it acquires some normalizable profile. And this extra dimension is related to the energy scale of the dual field theory. So that means that it is formed at some finite energy. If from the axion I had before, I extract the term corresponding to A1x, which is the one related to the one that breaks the symmetry spontaneously, you would end up having some kinetic term plus a massive mass term with mass squared equal to this thing. And as we approach the boundary, JTT goes to zero, so in principle, this could become tachyonic near the horizon. But the BF bound that I mentioned before has to be satisfied. And as a consequence of that, it condenses in a normalizable profile. And also this axiom that I have postulated somehow. It seems very arbitrary, but the idea is that we want to make it simple. We want, like, this is the most general thing that you can think of if you are asking, if you don't want to include higher derivatives, you want to include to just stay at second derivatives, and by requiring gauge invariants under diffeomorphisms and under gauge transformations, you end up with this thing. But it can be embedded into M theory also, so that it, the ADS-CFT duality can be applied to this axiom. This was work that was done by some other people. Okay, and now I'll explain to you a little bit more about the thermodynamics. So we said before that every solution of the bulk fields that we can find is dual or corresponds to some state of the field theory. In this case, since we have a black hole, that would be a thermal equilibrium state. Now, if we have two different solutions that both solve the equations of motion but are somehow incompatible, which one would be the one that is realized in nature? Then the quantity that you must look at is the free energy. The free energy, which in the gravitational theory is just the on-shell value of the Euclidean axiom over the temperature. And in these plots, what we see are the blue line shows the free energy of the, which one? Of the Leisner-Nordström solution, I think. Whereas the dotted red line shows the free energy of the other solution. It turns out that there exists a critical value of the parameter alpha, such that if we are taking an alpha lower than this critical value, the transition is second order, as corresponds to this diagram. Whereas for greater values of alpha, the transition is of this kind. So here you have a discontinuity on the derivative of the free energy, and that means that it's a first order phase transition. And the resulting diagram is the one I showed you before. So the transition here is second order, here is first order, and there is some range of temperatures for which this solution still exists, but it's not stable. It's metastable. Metastable means that if I perturb it a little bit, then the perturbations eventually grow until you end up with the preferred solution. Now, what we did in our work is to study perturbations around the stable solution in its case. So here, the preferred solution is the one with finite A1x, and that is called the superfluid phase, of course, because in that case the rotational symmetry is spontaneously broken, and you develop anisotropy, and eventually what you are developing there is a superfluid field theory. Whereas above this line, the Reisner-Nordström solution is preferred, and the theory is the normal fluid phase. Now, the perturbations that we are considering are, of course, of the metric and the gauge field. We can expand them in fewer modes. First, we have to apply some gauge fixing, because we need to make the calculations in some covariant way. So we fix the gates as much as we can by setting the radial components of the metric or of the gauge field to zero. And then for simplicity, in this longitudinal momentum, like we take momentum to be longitudinal, because if after the symmetries that were broken earlier, we were to introduce some momentum transverse to the x direction, then the remaining symmetry of rotations around the x axis would be also broken, so you would have no symmetries left. And we want to be able to interpret the results. So it's better if we only include longitudinal momentum so that this symmetry is preserved. And since we have this symmetry, we can classify the perturbation fields according to their transformation rules. So we have helicity 2, 1, and 0 states. I marked them with colors. So these parts of these components of the metric are set to 0 by gauge fixing. This one is helicity 2. And these two on the diagonal can be expressed in terms of their sum and difference, which are in each one of helicity 2 and helicity 0. Okay, and I will be also talking about these normalized perturbations. Besides that, we also took the simplifications of taking the momentum totally zero. That is useful because it allows us to classify them with respect to the longitudinal parity symmetry. So, in principle, if you go to flavor space, we explicitly broke it by selecting the three direction for the chemical potential. So you have the one and two indices. And then when in this superfluid phase, the symmetry is broken by selecting the one index for the condensate, the only symmetry that is left is to flip the sign of the two index. But also, since omega multiplies, or let's say it has two indices, index one and special index x, you could in principle flip all the fields which show index 1 or index x. And the, and under this change, the parity of this W component is even. So yeah, in the end, you have to look at for the indices x, 1, and 2. In particular, for instance, if you take the 10 helicity zero fields, you can see that they can be classified in, as even and odd under this parity. That allows us to differentiate between two different blocks of equations. And then that is not enough, because we also have some residual gauge symmetry that wasn't fixed by our choice. So in the end, if you look at the Einstein's equations, you can see that you only have four physical fields that can be built using the perturbation fields. And they are so that their asymptotic values are coincident to the asymptotic values of some perturbations. For this reason, we defined the perturbations so that the sum and difference of these ones were taken so that the XCM field corresponds to this physical field. And also, it is convenient to change the 1 and 2 indices to their fundamental representation, because in that way, the U1 symmetry is seen more clearly. Also, this is somehow a subtle calculation, because the action cannot be written in terms of these physical fields only. So you have to express it. Any perturbation that doesn't appear here, you keep it, but you change these ones in terms of the physical fields, like you replace them. And afterwards, well, you can set some values at the boundary. It's especially convenient to do it there, because you can use the ingoing boundary condition.
But the equations of motions can be expressed if it must. So what you are saying,
yes,
is that there are gauge invariant variables, which you call physical fields, and it is difficult to express action in terms of them. I think that's true. But the equations of motion you can express.
Yes, you can express the equations of motion for only the physical fields without involving anything else. Because to calculate the Green's function, we have to calculate the action on cell. And this expression. Yeah.
Okay, so then that becomes a sample.
Yeah. Okay, I won't get into that. Those details. I will show you the results we got. So, in the first paper by these authors, they studied the transverse thermoelectric effect. This effect is something observed in superfluids and noise systems. It consists in the appearance of some heat transport when you apply an electric field to the fluid, or equivalently, the appearance of electric current by a gradient of temperature. So here, this is the matrix that would generalize the simple relation of conductivity, like current equal conductivity times electric field. Well, in this case, you have to take the heat current, heat flux into play, and also the gradient of temperatures. And you can define four coefficients: conductivity, electric conductivity, thermoelectric conductivity, and thermal connectivity. They all have the same qualitative shape. It's of this kind, which is something resembling the future of superconductors. As you see in this region, the material would be an insulator, and here it shows a drastic increase of its conductivity. The line, the arrow here shows increasing temperature. So the orange curve is for a low value of the temperature, and the green one for a larger one, and so on. And you see that if as we get closer to the critical temperature, or as we surpass it, these curves they overlap with each other. These are features that were expected, and they are given by some generic relations for superfluids, for superconductors, let's say. The fact that they all asymptote to some linear behavior with a definite slope is a consequence of us having conformal symmetry in our setup. If we were studying a non-conformal superconductor like the ones we have in nature, this behavior shouldn't. So this part of the plot shouldn't be trusted so much. Now the features that I was mentioning, there's a rule that says that the area behind all these curves must be constant. So as we change the temperature, you see that the area seemingly changes. That is because there is a delta peak at zero frequency.
That rule is a well-established result, or is it the phenomenological?
I think it's phenomenological, yeah. And it must be satisfied by theoretical models.
It must be satisfied.
Yeah, because we also it was found by this system. So I guess we are not the only ones who found it.
So can you derive that rule from hydrodynamics?
Derive hydrodynamics?
Yeah. If it is so generic, it looks like you're saying that it's a generic feature of this system.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
But nobody knew about the driver. The fact that you said to these questions that it's a phenomenological, does that mean that people don't know how to derive that result?
Oh, no, I meant that it has been measured, but it can also be predicted theoretically.
Okay, so people understood that.
I think so, yeah. What I'm showing is the imaginary part of the connectivity times the frequency, because it would show a pole in zero frequency. And it turns out that the value of the frequency of the imaginary part at zero frequency is related to the delta peak that is observed on the other side. The behavior is given by this formula. Well, this is called a root peak, and it's some expression, and this is what appears in the superfluid phase and gives this feature of drastic increase.
Is the AS of alpha temperature independent?
What?
In general, why is it a simple problem?
I'm
saying
part?
A sub S, yeah, let's say, does that depend on temperature?
No, it doesn't.
Doesn't?
No. This is it's a constant. So it's linear. The component that appears in the superfluid phase is linear.
So this is
temperature.
More or less,
We also looked at the longitudinal thermodynamic effect. So that means that this, we are inserting x indices here, where x it was the preferred direction of the condensate. And since the frequencies of motion are coupled, we have to generalize this into this by involving also the A1t and A2t. The interpretation of these fields are that it's not a current, it's that the charge density is redistributed. So it doesn't change its magnitude, but it can rotate into the 1 and 2 flavor indices. Qualitatively, it's similar, only that it is observed at higher values of the frequency, and also near zero frequency, it doesn't go to zero, but it goes up again. And that is related to a quasi-normal mode that I will explain in a moment. Another effect that we saw is the piezoelectric effect, which relates then some components of the gauge field to components of the stress energy tensor. And that means that some electric current can be generated by stress forces. Or on the other side, a deformation in the material can be obtained by plugging in some external electric field. The intuitive picture here, explanation in the gravitational side, is that we have a background for which the value of A1x corresponds to some other values of the stress energy tensor. And if you modify that by adding some perturbation, this will respond in some way by also being slightly perturbed. The Green's function that we obtained for this case saw some bumps at some values of the frequency, which could be related to the appearance of quasi particles. And in the other parity block, what we observed is a very similar related effect. It's called the flexoelectric effect. In this case, instead of normal pressures, what would be triggering the appearance of electric current would be that you take this material and you bend it like in this figure. So it would be triggered by some shear deformation in the material.
So we're talking about the fluid, right? So how should I understand that? Practically, I mean, for solid, yes, I can understand for fluid, which is what we'll see now.
Well, for a fluid, you can also define formations and stresses.
So I understand that basically you're saying that there is a couple between TXX and JY, and so somehow you introduce the stress energy tensor. TXY, then it will produce a JY current. That's basically the statement you're saying. But the thing is that in solid, I know how to produce that stress energy tensor by bending, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there is a relation between strain and stress now.
Yeah.
That is, I don't know how to do that in fluid, that's the only thing.
In a fluid, you could think in terms of layers of fluid. Like you give this layer some velocity and the other layer another one. So a shear forces appear by the momentum is transferred.
Okay, so you produce just a shear.
Yeah.
That's not exactly bending.
No.
Right, that's
more simple.
Yeah.
And the Greenwich function that we have, that were obtained for this case are similar, only that the bumps are not so big. Another interesting thing that can be seen in the figures of the Greenwich functions are the appearance of Gaussian modes. Like the Gaussian modes are masses, so they enter the hyperdynamic description, and they are reflected in this correlators that we calculate by showing some divergence, a pole at zero frequency. The fact that the component H2X can be identified as a Gaussian mode is because if you take the A1X and 2X components of the gauge field and you express it this way, and remembering that you had a U1 symmetry between them, that can be understood as a, again, a Higgs type symmetry in which this phase acquires some expected value. And then by expanding this, you see that the phase is actually the A2X mode. The other Gaussian modes are A1Y and A1Z. And it's the same picture, only that in this three-dimensional space. We also looked at the quasi-normal modes. So quasi-normal modes would be values of the frequency generalized to be complex, for which the Green's function, the imaginary part of the Green's function, shows a pole. And depending on the temperature, the values of these complex frequencies can vary. Then, if we look at the correlators of the field 5-4, which is the physical field related to the, so 5-4 was related to the to this 3x component, and the other ones are the one with the Gaussian mode, and two more, like the A1x, is the one that is that A1x was related to the appearance of the current that breaks the isotropy and all that. As you see here, there's a pole at the zero frequency, there's another one here, and the way they move is the projection of these poles on the real axis of the frequencies. Okay. And finally, I will tell you about, we also looked at the viscosity tensor. So, viscosity is usually a scalar quantity, but here, since isotropy is broken, it is an entirely different thing. So, if you look at the book of Landau and Lifshitz, you will find that they define some dissipation function that contains all the friction forces internal that are inside the fluid. And the dissipative part of the stress energy tensor can be derived from that function. And the components that appear here form a tensor, so that if the fluid is isotropic, it's trivial, and if it's transversely isotropic, so there is one special direction chosen, they have this form. Now, if it's also conformal, some of them go away, they are zero. And in particular, we can look at these two components, which are called shear viscosities. This is all related to the 1/4 pi studies. So one of them acquires the universal value for any value of the temperature, whereas the other one acquires the 1/4 pi value, except if you go below the critical temperature, where it takes larger values. But the universal bound is satisfied anyway. And the arrow alpha indicates increasing values of alpha. And if you increase it over this critical value, then the form is of this kind, this multivalue. It is the presence of anisotropy, the fact that enables us to deviate from this value into greater values. Apart from that, there was another term in the viscosity tensor, which is called lambda. If we take all these components and we insert them into the dissipative part of the stress energy tensor, and I take just the difference of the x, and y components, I get this expression. And this part reminds us of one of the physical fields that we were considering. So the Green's function of this field can be, in fact, identified with this coefficient by means of a Kubo formula. And we also obtained some results for this coefficient, which is, it takes a totally different value. It's not 1/4 pi, because it is normalized in a different way. But the thing is that if you are in the unbroken phase, so above the critical temperature, it's basically the same thing as that. It is also a minimally coupled scalar, like its term in the axon is very similar to the one of the shear viscosity that acquired the 1/4 pi value, only that it has a different coefficient in front. In the broken phase, again, it increases. And this is interesting because it hasn't been observed in superfluids so far, but it has been observed in crystal liquids. That the interesting part is not that it's not its value, it's that it's positive, because in general, one should expect this coefficient to be negative. If it's positive, that means that if you apply a normal stress, the deformation would turn to be the opposite of what you expect. For instance, if I insert a rod in the fluid and I rotate the rod, I generate some centrifugal force. So you would expect that the fluid is expelled outwards. But in some materials, it turns out that fluid is attracted towards the rotating rod. This is called Weissenberg effect. We observe the same thing here. Like, this is a very small value, so it affects in the unbroken phase would be very little, but in the broken phase, it gets larger as you go to lower temperatures. Yeah. So just to conclude, our results have to do with some effects observed in semiconductors in superconductors, superfluids, crystal liquids, and they are all to be under, to be understood as an effective microscopic description that is only valid near the critical temperature, which is where we can apply the idea safety model. Our outlook would be to include the new Goldstone modes in a covariant hydrodynamic description of anisotropic superfluids, and to include finite momentum to be able to study the dispersion relations between these perturbations. Well, that's all. Thank you.
So I think you guys just hear you postulated a pretty good action, and you mentioned that you could have considered more complicated ones. So how can you argue that we saw something spontaneously won't change?
Well, the idea is that if you complicate the system, it gets like if you want to describe the helium 3 that you observe in nature, you don't even know if there is a gravitational dual for that. The axiom that I was posing is can be obtained as a limit of an axiom in string theory. Some people have been looking at that, trying to obtain the what I explained at the beginning, the symmetry, spontaneous symmetry breaking characteristic of a superconductor with that action. But it's complicated. And I'm not sure if you would gain much, because the main problem is that you are studying a conformal field theory on the other side.
Right, what I offer is, so you're doing, of course, you do the calculation you can, but then you're trying to make contact with experiments or with observed behavior.
Yeah.
So there is a gap there, and so what I'm trying to get is the backup to say, well, you can do what you can do, how much can you trust the results you get?
Well, they have to be trusted in a macroscopic limit. For long wavelengths and low energies, that's and near the phase transition, so near the critical temperature. Yeah, it's quite limited, but the thing is, the motivation is in the results themselves. Because just taking this very simple model, you can obtain the features of the connectivity. This several effects.
Yeah, so let me try a different way of asking that question. So you have identified new phenomena. So now you're going to try to convince experimentalists to go measure these things. Okay.
Yeah.
What's the sales pitch?
Yes, I would say that assuming that the field theory of the superfluids has a gravity dual, then that gravity dual in its most simple version would reduce to the system that we considered here. So this should be an approximation of what you have in the full theory. In any case, it's universal.
But I mean, again, as you said, it's universal in your models, so it doesn't make it universal. So the fact that lambda changes, if we start adding some scalar fields, they will affect. And the same for the non-universal part of the ethereal mass, the YZ component below the critical temperature. I think it just the fact that it's changing, that if I start adding scalar fields, that will start changing as well. So I'm saying that the honest answer to your question is, I don't know where we don't. I don't know if it is applicable to command spine. I mean, what you did, you reproduced in a gravitational setting some features of, you know, charged fluids, charged and isotropic fluids.
Yeah.
Now, what Luis was asking is how you can use this to make some predictions or use it somewhere. And I think the honest answer is that.
But this is a general question. It's not about this, about the whole field of ADS-CFT.
Right. So it is a model. It's not a genetic. So one thing is what you are trying probably to say is that there might be some universal features, but I don't see any universal features here.
Well, that.
So practically, the answer is you tell them, I think this looks like a reasonable model, and if you can confirm it, we'll have the first real test of this, of the ADS.
Yeah, there are many examples which that statement in many contexts, and the experimentalists have to choose one.
I'm totally sympathetic to the question.
Yeah. Okay, so the answer to your question is no, this is no practical implication. As lots of stuff that we do.
Maybe you're asking too much.
No, well, that's what he is asking. In doing something that has no practical implication.
I would say that it's already sensitive. You take a simple model and you take things that make sense.
No. Again, the in this activity, what you did, you took a known model, so people derived the low energy fluctuation picture in charged fluids, and that's, you know, anisotropic hydrodynamics. And what you did, you said, I can take that and reproduce it with gravity. That's a fair statement. I would say that I can be probably too harsh, but my understanding is that that's pretty much what the stuff is being done, right? So it's not like we discover something. Even, you know, say in this model that people didn't know. Is that do you think a fair statement? Is there something in this particular thing? Is there something that you found that can be useful? So that's why I was asking you whether people knew that the area, for example, was constant or something like that. So that would be, if they wouldn't know, and you found that the area is constant, then there is some motivation to actually study this and use gravitational picture in order to prove that statement.
But what would be kind of more positive, right? And say, well, with this model, they're able to reproduce a bunch of things that are known. And so then you say, well, given that you reproduce the next step, but it's not known, some of this new phenomenon that may be believable as something that could have a conflict. Well, this things you mentioned before, and this this lab positive lambda that we calculated that hasn't been observed in supercondensable fluids yet. But
don't prove that lambda cannot be negative. So, for example, how are we sure that would be an interesting statement? If you can prove in a full generality, even in the supergravity approximations, that lambda is always positive, that would be an interesting statement. But so far, it's just in this particular model, the answer is that I'm not saying that it's any bad, because the same story is with shear is possible.
Yeah.
So in, you know, in some class of models, it's a little bit wider, it's 1/4 pi. In the other classes of models, it's large or small. So it's the same story.
Well, that would be the next step. Try to take this and make it more universal.
Make it not
constrained to this particular model.
Right. So see which features stay universal if you start adding the additional charge scales. But this one is already pretty impractical, even though you're a very modest person. I know that it's horrible computation you have done, so especially with fluctuations.
Another thing is that everything is like mixed up here because we obtain things, we come to obtain superconductivity and all that. In principle, it's not known that helium 3 superfluid is also superconductive. Like it's not established experiment.
So the same thing, it's not, what's not established?
That helium 3 superconducts at very low temperature. Helium 4 is known to be an insulator.
But why do you expect that question has anything to do with it? It's clearly that if we take a DSCFT, the models that we're talking about has nothing to do with superfluid.
It has.
What exactly? I mean, this model has, you know, this is large air, right? So this is some gauge here. So it has, you know, at temperature, if I ask you at some temperature, what's the entropy density? The correct answer is infinity, because it's n goes to infinity. I know I'm just playing the devil's advocate. So this is, I know that there are lots of overselling that's going on. You know, we try to pick up some model and say that it is, you know, whatever, applied to the helium, but it's not. It is applied to whatever. So you talk about AGS-5. So presumably what you're talking about is that you start with an equal force with a symmetric MMS, and then you added this additional center, which is described by non-abelian bulk HV. So that's some deformation of that n equal 4 n. So if we are 100% honest, then all these effects, they are described in that particular gauge theory and deformation of n equal 4. Now what I'm saying is that that has nothing to do, okay, I don't see how it has to do with helium.
Well, the idea is that at the critical point, field theory that describes helium becomes important.
But that's okay, so first of all, in gravity, you get only mean field critical points. So, mean field critical points are described if we are realistic, we use supergravity approximation, then it's only mean field. But the mean field, that's Landau Ginzburg field. So, you basically reproduce gravity and criticality is just Landau Ginzburg.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank Daniel again.